Okay, hi everybody. So I think if we think about the Gedolim, who have most affected the Jewish world, the whole Jewish religious world, and all of its segments, today, you know, for Tav Shinayin Dalet, 2014, like two names that I would think come up would be the Chafetz Chaim, right? Is there anybody who doesn't learn Mishneh Berurah, any section of Orthodoxy, doesn't learn Mishneh Berurah? It's everywhere, right? And what would be the second name? What would be the second name? My second name would be Rav Meir Shapiro. Why? Because he made
Daf Yomi.
And think about how many people you know and how much a term that is everywhere, right? Modern Orthodox people learn Daf Yomi. Told the Siren people learn Daf Yomi. Sephardim learn Daf Yomi. Ashkenazim learn Daf Yomi. Chasidim learn Daf Yomi. Everybody. Litaim learn Daf Yomi. Right? It's everywhere. And that was really the... That was his thing, okay? So we're going to focus today on this phenomenal Gadol named Meir Shapiro. Now, if you remember about a month ago, four Tuesdays ago, we discussed, too, the Panovich Rav. It's interesting to speak just for a second about a comparison between the two of them. So they shared a lot, right? They shared a lot of things. One of the things they shared was they both built yeshivas from scratch, right? Panovich Rav built Panovich in Bnei Brak from scratch, like we said. He had to remake it after the war. There was nothing. Started with how many students, we said? Six students to make it one of the biggest yeshivas and greatest yeshivas in the whole world. And Rav Meir Shapiro built Chachmei Lublin, besides making the Daf Yomi, he also made the Chachmei Lublin yeshiva, which is still standing in Lublin today. And thank God it's under Jewish control. You can go in there, and I went in there. And I had a shiur from Rav Noach Weinberg in this building, this very building. And that was, which we're going to talk about, that was, he built from scratch. That was one comparison. Two, they were both unusually great Talmidei Chachamim, who at the same time as being unusually great Talmidei Chachamim were very, very involved in Tzarchi Tzibur. They were very, very involved with the community. Right? That was another comparison. The third comparison is they both served in their respective parliaments, which is pretty amazing to think about. We'll talk about that later. The Panovich Rav was, I don't think we mentioned that 4 weeks ago, was in the Lithuanian parliament, and the Rav Meir Shapiro was in the Polish parliament, okay, for 5 years. They were both outstanding orators, Pam Mafik Margolius. They're famous speakers, both of them. Meir Shapiro, everybody knew what a great speaker he was, and Panovich Rav was a phenomenal speaker. And maybe most, the love of the Jewish people, Torah and Hashem, burned extremely brightly in both of their hearts. Okay, so that was the comparison. But there's a very significant difference in what they did, and this is what I want to focus on now for a second. Okay, when we think about the Panovich Rav, what did he do? He rebuilt Torah after the war, like we spoke about. From nothing. Remember, he had one kidney said to him, rebuild Panovich. He didn't have a second kidney. If he would have had a second kidney, what would have said to him? Yaska Dubista Meshugana. You're going to rebuild Panovich? But he didn't have a second kidney, so he didn't get the eights, he didn't get the advice from a second kidney, and therefore he went ahead and built Panovich, right? Now, listen well, guys. That was a crazy thing to do, a crazy accomplishment, a dream, but it wasn't a radical revolutionary thing to do. At the end of the day, he was rebuilding Torah, which is a reasonable thing to do, an understandable thing to do. The proportions that he wanted to do. What Rav Meir Shapiro was a changer. He was coming to change things, right? He changed the way Rebbeim got paid. He was the president of Gudin in Poland, which itself was a big chiddush. The whole concept of yeshiva in Poland, like he had made, was a radical concept, which we'll talk about. And Daf Yomi was a radical new thing. Now here I want to explain a very, very important point, right? This I think is a big yisod, and this will help you guys understand a lot of things you see in the world, a lot of different attitudes that you see amongst different gedolim and things like that. Okay, Klai Yisrael, halacha, simple minhagim, the way we tie our shoes, right? The way we tie our shoes is holy. We are the Jewish people. Whatever we do is holy, right? Our Mesorah, our traditions are holy. And therefore, as much as they're holy, for sure we're very careful. We're very careful not to change them so fast. You wonder sometimes, well, just change everything. Just make yeshivas different. Just do this, just do that. Why not change minhagim, change things? Yeah? The Jewish people, what we do is holy. I want to tell you a story that happened. I think this is really like from the Yesodus foundational points of Yiddishkeit for us to understand how things work today. Okay? There was in Kovna, I believe, a Jew, the minig in Kovna was to get married in the courtyard of the shul. Okay? Christians have cemeteries in their courtyards. Jews got married in their courtyards, the courtyard of the shul. You know, the church has a... So it's a deep thing that churches have cemeteries next to it. Christianity is all around death. He died. He came dead. Died. I didn't make that up. It's like a deep thing. Anyway. So, right? So someone got married in the courtyard in the Kovna Shul. Right? No. The custom was to get married. A rich person in the community, an upstanding member of the community, took his marriage ceremony and got married in his own house. Okay, doesn't sound like such a bad thing, but it's going against the custom in the town. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the Gadol Ador about 4 or 5 generations ago, was a very, very famous person, right? Yitzchak Elchanan, Yeshiva's Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan is named after him. So he put him in, what would you do to this guy? He excommunicated him. Chayrim! You changed the minig, you changed the custom, you got chayrim. I heard the story from my Rebbe, who heard it from Tzal Ojolti, who was the famed Rav of Yerushalayim, Tzal Ojolti. Right now, it's also a street. Where? In Ramat Shlomo. Named after who? Bezalel Ojolti. Right? It proves he existed. Okay, Rabbi says, so that rabbi told my rabbi story, who told me this story. And someone said that, and Rabbi Elchanan, by the way, was known as a moderate. If you read about him, he was known as a moderate. He wasn't called a kanoi. He wasn't a zealot amongst the gedolim. Some gedolim were zealots. Some, right? He was. So what are you putting the guy in communication? What are you excommunicating him for? Because he got married in this house instead of the courtyard of the shul? What's the big deal? So you say like this. Somewhere the rabbis say the Torah is like a gal shelagozim. It's like a pile of nuts. Like, this is Yisodas Yiddishkeit, guys. It's like a pile of nuts. What's a pile of nuts? If you pull out one nut, then the whole thing comes undone. But now he asks this question. Why does it call it a pile of nuts? Why not call it a pile of oranges, a pile of apples? I just had an apple on my way in. Yeah? Call it a pile of apples. You pull out one apple, it also all falls down. So he said an unbelievable thing. That with an egozim, there's a inside part and there's an outside part. The outside part is just a shell. It doesn't have any value. But you know what? Even if there's no pre inside the shell, even if there's nothing in there, it also holds up the whole thing. When you pull that one out, you say, "Well, hey, the pile should have come tumbling down because the one I pulled out was a bad nut anyway. There's nothing inside. No, it doesn't make a difference. The chitzoni things, hear this, guys. The chitzoni aspects, the outside aspects of Yiddishkeit also hold up Yiddishkeit." The way we dress, the way we tie our shoes, things which don't necessarily make a difference also hold up Yiddishkeit. So when we start playing around with them and we move them around, the whole thing can fall.
You see that? That was kind of a crazy thing. The outside things that have no the outside value things, or
original. No, that they don't really have a value besides the way you do things. It's not that there's anything really there. That's the point of the Gal Shelagozim.
So shtick has inherent value.
Shtick, if it's a shtick which is...
It's real shtick.
If it's part of the way things do. And everybody who knows the history of the Conservative and Reform Party knows that they start out with small changes. Because small changes, we don't do it like that anymore. Oh, you don't do it like that, so then things roll.
Effect.
What?
The snowball
effect, exactly. Okay, so therefore, that's just a little bit of explanation. Let me just finish the section and I'll take questions. So that's why we find a tendency amongst many Gedolim not to move and change things, right? And this is the way we did it. And why do we do it? We keep doing it because that's the way we did it. And why do we keep doing it that way? Because that's the way we did it. That's the way we did it. And that's the way we did it. And that's what's kept Yiddishkeit going. But my friends, on the other hand, there were Gedolim, right, and others who came at necessary points in history and did make significant changes in things. And only by those changes did they keep Yiddishkeit going? Let's give a few names. The Baal Shem Tov. Chassidus was a change. Chassidus is, we're sitting 300 years later, and we know that Chassidus was a great thing 350 years later, and we know that the Besh saved the Jewish people by what he did. The Baal Shem Tov saved the Jewish people. Rabbi Sorel Salanter. Rabbi Sorel Salanter made the Musar movement. He saved the yeshivas in Europe through it. If anybody understands what was going on now, not the time right now. And that was a change, and many people were against Rabbi Sorel Salanter. You know, there were people who said, Yisrael, the best name was Yisrael. So he used to say, Yisrael, Yisrael, Gzera Shava. Both of them equal Bittel Torah. Chassidus is Bittel Torah, wasting time from learning. And Musar is wasting time from learning. Gzera Shava, Yisrael, Yisrael, right? Sarishnir, maybe we'll talk about, right? Sarishnir made Beis Yaakov. That was a change. Beis Yaakov was a change, and that saved Yiddishkeit, right? Etc. And Rameir Shapiro also on a different level. So now I think like this. These two poles are things that we have to appreciate and understand. On the one hand, we have to keep Yiddishkeit going, right? On the other hand, there are times when things need a change, right? Now, who's to decide? Only the Gedolim to decide, right? We can't decide that. But you do find in the camp of Gedolim, two different types of Gedolim. Gedolim are always going to say, keep things going, right? The way it was. Don't change things around. It's dangerous. And Gedolim, we're going to feel that there's a necessity to change here, because if we don't make a change, things are going to go... And this goes on out of Yom HaZeh. I don't know if you understand a little bit what's going on in the Haredi world today, the Haredi Yeshiva world today. This goes on, different Gedolim. Some of them feel that a change is necessary for different reasons, and some of them say you can't change anything. So we see these two. Now you say to yourself, I want to be the guy. I have a good age. If you want to be the guy who decides these things, very simple, right? 15 hours a day, 25 years, that's Lacha Rabba. Then maybe we could talk. Huh? It's only for Gedolim to decide these things. But that gives us, so why did I give this all Hakdama? Because I want you to appreciate, this is not necessarily well known, that Rameir Shapir was like, from what I've read, it's clear in this book written by a student of his, Yeshua Baumel, that he was definitely of that other category. He saw where there's room to change things, he wanted to change. Obviously, we're not talking about changing Allah, God forbid, but as we'll see, there are many, many moves that he made and changes that he made that when he felt it was necessary. Okay? Any questions up to now?
I was just going to add that it's also, there's a famous thing, if you flip around backwards, you can see ahead.
Right.
It's just as bad as if you're
going to
go against the minhag.
Ah, nice. If minhag is because that's cute. Because some people say like minhagim, like some people say I have a minhag to mix. Some people say I have a minhag to mix dance or to mix swim. That's the shot that minhag is gehenna. But you're saying minhag is osius gehenna because if you go against the minhag, it's gehenna. I like it.
You should go ahead.
Yeah.
Before, so what exactly
guys, but I'm telling you again, this is a biggie. So I just gave you the keys to understand many, many things. Yeah.
Can you explain that? What exactly did you change? Is your evolution?
We're going to talk about it.
That's an introduction. Can you tell me exactly how what you just said before I asked the question? How is it such a yisod?
Because
everything.
Because it explains to us a lot of what goes on. You look and you say, I see a problem. How come people don't change it? Or I see some Gedolim yes changing it. So I'm giving the foundations for understanding a lot of thinking that you see amongst great people. You know what I'm saying?
Because it'll actually...
Because some people don't want...
Even though it itself has no value.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to see these tendencies, you know, amongst the Gedolim all the time. Yisrael Salanta was a person who changed things, you know.
All right, so where did either of these Yisraels or Zer Shevel come on to say that, no, if I bought this
nut... You know, they... Okay, because they were huge people who had learned more than 25 years or more than 50 years.
They knew a better muscle.
And they had a... Right, exactly. They had a sense that this... Yeah, you're right, but the time is such that we have to... And we're going to, you know, and it was a tricky thing. Okay, one thing about Rameir Shapir, on a lighter note, both say he was fabulously witty and he was quick-tongued, right? When he was in the parliament one time, an anti-Semite came over to him and said, Rabiner, Shapiro, do you know that in Schleissen it says that no dogs or Jews are permitted? So he turned right back to me and says, so that means neither me nor you can go there. Yeah. Okay. Someone was selling when he was in parliament. So one time there was someone selling socks, right? So he said socks. He says, Rabbi, would you like to buy some socks? No, not the Chose, Rameir Shapiro. No, the Chose is somebody else. Very earlier, right? So someone was selling socks for both sides, right? So he says, you want to buy some socks? So he said, you know, I don't have socks. This is why. I said, I'm involved in politics. Politics is all sheker. It's all untruth. And the Gemara says that Sheker doesn't have raglaim, it doesn't have legs. So I don't have any legs, right? So if I don't have any legs, I don't need any socks. So that's you wouldn't buy the socks. Finally, this is a story I love to tell. An American child, we're going to learn about his trip to America, where he was in America for 13 months and gave 242 drushes, 242 speeches to collect money for his great yeshiva, Chachmei Lublin. And the kid comes over and he says, Rabbi, he came over to him after a speech. Obviously, he spoke, he didn't know English, he spoke in Yiddish, and most American Jews back then knew Yiddish. So he says to him, Kinder, you know, do you know Yiddish? He said, no. He said, but I think the Rav was asking for money. He said, oh, if you understood that, you understood better than everybody else. Okay? When was he born? Zayin Adar, Bosa. His yard site is coming up. Right? Zayin Adar, 7th of Adar, same day as Moshe Rabbeinu, 1887, and he died at only around 46, 47. Okay? The person we're talking about, you're going to see the phenomenal amount that he did in his life, and he was only 46, 47. I'm 45, you understand? I don't want you to compare me to him. This is going to be a shocker for you guys. Okay, his youth. He, of course, had a lot of his youth, as everybody does, had a lot of ashpa on his future achievements. I always like to quote something that his mother, a lot of things his mother used to say to him, you saw later in life that he would he would say those things over. And believe me, a lot of things you guys say over, it's really because of what mom told you once upon a time, right? She used to say, Marilyn, my child, see to it that you study well and learn Torah, because every day that goes by with no Torah learned is something precious lost that can never be gotten back. And who knows what the day next day will bring. And when he started Daf Yomi, what did he say? We have to spend time with Torah every day by studying the Daf Yomi, because every day that goes by without Torah study is something precious lost that will never be gotten back. And who knows what the next day will bring. And when her mother, you know, this is not necessarily suggested for today's times, but his mother really pushed him in learning, you know, to go deeper and deeper into things. And he said he was working hard and he was applying himself, but she drove him on to greater effort. And he said, what did she say? For such a great Torah, for such a great and mighty Torah, this is too small a sacrifice. You didn't do enough yet, Marilla. For such a great Torah, that's all you gave. One Seder, two Starim, till 10 o'clock at night. Keep going. So when he would ask someone for money, and the guy would give too modest a donation, what would he hit him between the eyeballs with? My dear sir, for such a great and mighty Torah, this is too small a sacrifice. Yeah, so it's sweet that he used to say things that his mother told him. Anyway, he was a super prodigy. We're not supposed to say that, but he was. What can he do? At 9 years old, he already knew all Yoridea word for word. At 15, Yoridea and Shulchan Aruch, the whole one of the four books of the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch, he knew the whole thing word for word. At 15, he started learning Kabbalah, the mystical part of the Torah, with an unquenchable thirst, right? And what's very sweet is specifically his idea to make a great yeshiva happen when he was only 8. Isn't that unbelievable? He came from a well-off family, and he married, I think, a well-off girl. And he saw other children who were as talented as him that nothing became of them because their parents couldn't afford Malamdim, etc. And that's where it first started going in his tremendous brain and heart that he's got to make a yeshiva, which we'll see, that everybody has a chance to learn, you know, not just those who have money. So already this is already by a young person. So anyway, so before we start speaking about his accomplishments, we're going to focus mostly on his accomplishments, but I want to speak a little bit about what the man was like. What was he like as a person? A beautiful account here is offered in this book. This is all from the book, which I highly suggest reading, A Blaze in the Darkening Gloom. I've culled from some other sources, but most of this class is from that book. There seemed to be a magnetism in this great educator, which cast a spell over everyone who came in contact with him. The living dynamics of his character evoked vibrations of holiness, self-effacement, and spiritual ascent. Every word here is gold. The kind of responses which had occurred in masses of Jews when they were exposed to the influence of the great founding fathers of the Hasidic world. When you imagine what the Baal Shem Tov was like back then, the Magid Mezrich, he evoked that thing. This is a man who spoke to the masses. This is a man who they were magnified to. Time and again, those legendary figures thawed and warmed Jewish hearts and souls, which had become frozen. Somehow they had the power to draw Jewish hearts to a genuine worship of the Creator. In a blazing enthusiasm, Rameir personified the earliest, most authentic Hasidic doctrines, faith and trust in Hashem, unmitigated cheerfulness, and a boundless enthusiasm and longing for an infinitely remote yet all-encompassing divinity. Okay, so what did he have? Faith and trust in Hashem. He was always happy, enthusiasm for Vodas Hashem, and always a longing to the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? A great Rav in America described him like this. How do you describe him? Let's see. The historic visit of the great Torah scholar of Pietrikov, that's where it was, the Rav, had lifted high the prestige, this is when he was in the States, has lifted high the prestige of the Torah, unfurling its banner and its ensign as of Jewish majesty. The great mighty influence of that visit is still felt today in our land. His name has remained venerated, recalling this extraordinary personage to whom every sensitive soul felt drawn. He walked into a room, he caught the whole room, you were swept away by Rameir Shapir, and he could rouse people to great emotion. He went one time before he made Chachmei Lublin, so he went to the Lithuanian yeshivas. There were no yeshivas in Poland, which we're going to talk about. He made yeshivas where there were none. In all of huge Poland with 3 million Jews, there were no yeshivas. So he had to go to the Lithuanian yeshivas, right? There were no Hasidic yeshivas to see what they were like.
Why were there no yeshivas if the Jews were there?
We're going to talk about it. But so when he was in Radin, which is the Chavetz Chaim Yeshiva, which knew about great men, so he went and he told them, He said, when I was there in America and I wasn't making any money and I was sitting all despondent and sad, and I sat on my bed and I started singing to myself, Ima Marti Mata Ragli Chastach Hashem Yisadein, if my foot will stumble, the Chesed Hashem will hold me up. And then, at a later point in time, I got $1,000 for being a chazan on the Yom Narayim, the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and I sang to myself again, Hashem has picked me up, Chastach Hashem Yisadeini, the Chesed, the cheer, the goodness of Hashem has held me, like Siad Dishmai Sa'adeini, and he got all the Bochurim and Rodin singing and dancing with him when he was telling the story, right? He was like that type of person. He just swept you along. And for years later, they remembered his visit in Radin. He transmuted, again, and these are people who saw the Chafetz Chaim. You understand? They weren't people who had no sense of Kedusha. For he transmuted our weekday, workday environment into the festive atmosphere of a Yom Tov. Into melancholy, he infused a pulsing, living niggun. It was a great day when we set eyes on him in holiness. We were privileged to see his spiritual might and majesty. Did you ever see something like this? With the divine luster of his seraphic countenance, he would infuse so warm a spirit of sublime, noble, holy life. We get the picture, guys? This is a man of holiness. When you saw him, you felt, this is the real McCoy. This is the real deal, okay? So now, with that said, we can try to go into his activities a little bit, right? So
we say it sounds like they don't sense that off the Chofetz Chaim.
No, they did. No. Sure they.
Chofetz Chaim and I.
Of course they did. You didn't say.
Chofetz Chaim wasn't enough of the man. So
no, it could be they were used to the Chofetz Chaim. You know, when you get used to, listen, you guys see me a lot. What does it do anymore? First time you saw me, you remember what it was like. And the first time you saw Rabbi Elsand, you know. And now, you know, it's like that with everybody. I remember the first time I saw Rabbi Elsand today. Okay, Rabbi, so that's. Okay, guys, so listen, remember we said this is many kids, and I know to us today these things aren't going to seem like chidushim, they're not going to seem like new things, but you have to appreciate them in the times. Many kids were leaving the cheder system, right, to go get an education, and when they would leave the education to get the yeshiva system to get parnasa back then, it meant very often they were going off to derech. So his Rebbe, was the chork of a Rebbe, came up with an idea. He says, we're going to make two chadarim, right, two elementary schools. One for those who are more gifted and more fit for learning, and one for others. And there are going to be two significant differences, okay? One difference is that they're going to learn a trade together in the cheder, right? The ones who can become big learners in Rabbanim will leave them the way they are. But these kids, we're going to teach them a trade, and we're going to teach them more halacha, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because the person who could be a big Talmud Chacham, so leave him alone with the shas, and he'll figure it out. But a person who can go into Parnas needs more halacha. So to us, that sounds like such a simple idea. So he went, he got support of other rabbis, but then he met tremendous resistance to this, because again, it was a change. And every change is always going to be met with resistance, right? But eventually, when he was a Rav himself in Glina, a place called Glina, so then he did in fact put this change in. And when he became a Rav, he again had, although he did many, many, you know, I'm just trying to get, we don't have so much time, so I'm just focusing, you know, this is basically 2 hours of class, I'm making it to one. But he did many changes. He stood up for Yiddishkeit a lot. But his main focus in the town was, guess what? What was the main thing that he was focused on?
Kids.
Kids, meaning what? Sounds like the E word?
Education.
Education. His focus was always education. That's a very important thing, right? And he again did something revolutionary. So it's not going to sound revolutionary to you, but Malamdin used to get paid by who? Malamdin was the person who taught. Guess who paid them? The parents, right? The parents used to have to pay the Malamdin themselves. And he said there are two problems with this. What are the problems with this, my friends?
One,
the poor kids aren't learning. Two, the Malamdim are running around after for the money, and that's mashvil them. That puts them down, right? So he says, you know, we're making a new system. The school is going to pay the Malamdim, and the parents are going to pay the school. So again, to us that's a simple thing, but back then that was a change. That was a new thing, okay? And he, like we said before, he made the Cheder Klali model. That was called Cheder Klali to Chadarim. That he did that in his town. And he always had a sense the Torah has to be beautiful. We're going to see that when we talk about Chachmei Lublin, the yeshiva. If you look at the building itself, you know, it's an awesome building. You can see it on six floors. You can only see the back of it now. But you can see what a prestige. This, he didn't buy this, right? He made this building from the ground up. There was nothing there. It was a plot. And he knew the Torah had to be created in the greatest, most beautiful way, and that's what he did. And the chadarim that he had built in Glina, where he was Rav, were beautiful chadarim because he's got special money for that, etc. Another thing he did was make a teachers' institute. right? Now that seems simple to you and me again, but that wasn't what you did. In Yerushalayim, you said to Yerushalmi Rebbe, you know, who used to like next to hit the kids with a, I have a friend like that, he sent his kid to Eitz Chaim, he says, we teach the David Goldberg, the other Goldberg. He says, we do it the old way over here. Kids get smacked, you know, you're gonna go tell them we're having a teacher's institute. You don't have a teacher's institute, you're a shugana. That's not the way we did it, right? But he did create a teacher's institute, and he had a beautiful reasoning for that. He says, we spend so much time on shechita when it comes to a shochet to make sure he knows what he's doing, right? How many qualifications do we expect from a shochet? In the smallest shtetl, to give the community kosher meat. He has to know all the halachas, he has to have Yerush Shemaim, he can't make mistakes, he has to have a clear hand, and he has to be from. And what do we put in his hands? A para, an ox. And what qualification should a malamed have? Should a teacher have? We give him our children. We give him this young souls. We're giving him the foundation of Yiddishkeit's next generation. And we don't have any qualifications? You get the type of thinking? This was his type of thinking, okay? And when he made the schools, he used to come and quiz the kids and he'd leave it on its own. Okay, so now another thing that is highly involved, and you can imagine, a Gudis Yisrael. Now let's understand what a Gudis Yisrael was back then. Gudis Yisrael was founded in 1909 in Germany. Okay, Germans are known for order, organization, unity. Those are big concepts, right? There was a need for Orthodox representation because there were so many other groups, Jewish groups, coming up to claim that they were the true representatives of the Jewish people, conservative, reform, Bundist, Zionist, etc. So there's a tremendous need for Orthodox Jewry to put themselves together, right, and unite under a single banner. But it was a new concept again, right? So some Rabbanim were against the Gudah. I would say, you want to be from, there's always someone firmer than you. You have to know that in life, you know what I mean? There's always someone who, there's always, now Kamtza, you guys know the story of Kamtza Bar Kamtza?
Yeah.
Kamtza? Right, you know, that, the whole Chorban was because of the story of Kamtza Bar Kamtza and Gittin. So the Munkacher Rebbe, I just want to show you the other way of thinking, right? The Hungarian Gedolim, which Satmar was from Hungary. So Munkacher Rebbe made a drasha like this. Kamtza is what? Kuf Mem Tzadik Aleph. Let's figure out. Kuf is communist, right? You have to get the whole thing here. Don't get offended. Mem is Mizrahi. Tzadik is
Tzioni.
Got it. Aleph is what? A Gudda. He put a Gudda together with the communists and the Tzionim. You understand? This is, what are you making a new thing here? We're all getting together, and the Germans and the Germans, the Hasidish, the Litvish together, we're going to lose the Mesora. And the Salman Rebbe was never part of a Gudda. You know that? He was never part of a Gudda. He would never be part of a Gudda. That was like an extreme. Samar is like an extreme in the first way we're done. Nothing changed. That's why Hasidim, right? We don't look, you know, this time my mother got me in America, I don't know how, you know, modern it looks, but whatever. It's not probably not what my great-grandfather was wearing. Maybe it's the exact same one and my mother saved money. I don't know, right? Most of it, but Hasidim look exactly the way they looked 150 years ago. Right? That's how they look. And there's a lot to that because you don't change the Mesorah and you keep things the same way, okay? So anyway, so you can imagine, so when a Gudda came, so start, I just want to say a side point for 1 second. We don't give any credit. Any Germans here? Any Yekis? I think it's a very important historical point. So much to talk about, guys. Any Yekis? So Yekis, we don't give credit to German Jewry, right? What do we like? We learn with Hasidim. We learn with Litvaks. If you want to daven and go to a tishy, go to Hasidim. You learn, you want to pick, open a sefer, you open up a Svas Emes, right? 2:35 in the conference room Thursdays. Svas Emes class, a schoolmaker, if you want. Anyway, if Rabbi Elsek has permission, Rabosai, right? Germans, that's not part of the Mesorah. You have to know that German, that we live today so much on German Jewry, and I'll prove it to you. Aguda, which was this tremendous body, which all the Gedolim eventually embraced, was a German invention. And I want to say a stronger thing. One person who saved Yiddishkeit, one woman who saved Yiddishkeit was named what? Sarshnir, who was Polish. But the whole Beis Yaakov movement, and her herself, was permeated with the Hashkafas of German Jewry. Reb Shimon Shiner Fulhirsch was the main source of curriculum for Beis Yaakov and for Sarshnir herself. And one of the flag greatest teachers of Beis Yaakov was named Judith Rosenbaum, who eventually became Judith Grunfeld, who was a direct product of German Jewry. She was a German girl. So you have to know, it's an interesting thing. Anyway, that's a side point. Give credit for Yekis. You know what I'm saying? You have to appreciate what they've given to all, again, like we started, we're talking about all Judaism together. So anyway, both sides. So this is a gouda. So now gouda's also changed, like we said. The Munkachers aren't into gouda. Hungarians aren't into gouda. Samer's not into gouda. But someone like Rameir Shapiro embraced a gouda very strongly because he saw that this is what we have to do today. And when he's only 33 years old, 35 years old, in 1922, the Rabbanim, the Gedolim, I think it was the Ger Rebbe and the Chavetz Chaim, saw that he had such koach as a orator, an organizer, a spokesperson, a leader. So he was thrust to head a gouda in Poland. He became the president of a gouda. Okay, so he's the president of a gouda. And he said, this was the idea that to make a Yiddishkeit, which all Judaism could come under, and have youth, which had something to be proud of when Judaism was getting so attacked on the left and the right, center, etc. This is a major goal of his. Now, this is interesting. It says, you have to understand for a second. Can you imagine Rav Eliashiv in Knesset? You know, could you imagine that? Rav Eliashiv sitting with volunteer politicians all day, or Rav Shlomo Zalman, right? Or even Rav Hillel Weinberg. Could you imagine it? Like, it just doesn't, it doesn't fit, you know? It doesn't fit. Imagine some older, well, it'd be a waste of time for them, you know, they have to sit and hear politics and so. Politicians, are, do you think politicians just became dirty today? The Mishnah told us 2,000 years ago, Al-Tikar of Lamalchus, right? Ugh. I don't want to be a politician. I mean, I would consider beneath me, and that's really low. You understand, to be a politician, it's not a respectful job. He went into the Sem, because that was what Klal Yisrael needed, for 5 years. We mentioned before, could you imagine? 5 years. You say, I sit and I cry for the Bittul Torah that I have to, the waste of time and all the shkar and foolishness that I have to hear. But that's what he did, because Klal Yisrael needed it. He knew it was a time. I'm going to read what they, how his Talmud wrote about it. It's moving here. He was a living saver Torah, but he knew this was no time to stay in the safe, cozy confines of his base measure studying away. He could never bury his head in the sand before threatening danger. He could never ignore reality or blind himself to it. And he saw what a time of danger was for the observant, believing Jews in Poland. In such a situation of dire danger, it was certainly not the time for a spiritual leader to sit and close in the confines of Talmudic study and halacha. He had to appear before the people and persuade and compel the Torah Jews to see the situation as he saw it. Could you imagine? He's out there campaigning. Do you understand what it is? But again, it's not, I could campaign. You understand? He's a gadol shebigdolim. Sitting in Kabbalah, sitting, everybody knows, his shurim and everything like that. And all he would want to do is sit and learn. But he knew the Klal Yisrael needed him out there, and he went out there for 5 years, okay? He was so good at it that someone said to him, you know, and then he said, "What? You're spending so much time in the Sem." Remember how he said how sharp he was and how fast he was? So listen to this one. He said, "You're so good in Parliament, why are you spending time?" It was called the Sem back then. "Why are you spending time on education?" Huh? Right? Because he was splitting his time. Part of the time he was developing Kachmi Lublin, developing the yeshiva. Part of the time he's in Parliament. So he's so good. He says, "You know, you remind me of a pasuk." Listen to this one, guys. It says, the pasuk says, "V'yikanu Moshe b'machane v'aron kodesh Hashem." It's Tehillim Kuvav. V'yikanu, and they, we're going to translate it as, they challenged. They challenged Moshe in the machane, right? They challenged Moshe in the encampment. And Aaron they challenged in the Beis HaMikdash. That's what the verse means. So he says, what did people say to him? To Moshe they said, "Moshe, you should be in the Beis HaMikdash. What are you doing in the encampment?" And to Aaron they said, "What are you spending so much time in the Beis HaMikdash? You should be in the encampment." You got it? Hey, wherever they are, you can't win. That's what he said to them. Anyway, so as we mentioned, the Panavitra was also in some. So we're both saying, so we get a picture of who this was. This was a man who was a phenomenal, unbelievable gadol who could bring everybody under the banner of Torah together, was an amazing personality that evoked old Hasidic rabbis of hundreds of years before, right? And would have liked nothing better than to sit and learn all day and just to be a rav, a small-time rav in a town. But he knew that Klal Yisrael needed other things from him, and he was always thinking, as we'll end soon with this. Okay, let's talk about Dabi Yomi. Certainly his most famous, but ongoing. Now, but you get a picture now? So how was he the one who was Zocha to Daf Yomi? Do you understand the ripple effect of Daf Yomi? Thousands of Jews every cycle being Mechadish. Everywhere you go, you see Daf Yomi. And how many Gemaras are built for Daf Yomi? There's like 20-page Gemaras. Whoever had 20-page Gemaras before? Yeah? It's all because of him. So you get a picture. Now you understand how he was the one who made such a tochnin and such a program. And he was the one who was Zocha to his program, has impacted all levels of Orthodoxy for so long. Okay, so anyway, I want to tell you a historical fact. To my knowledge, he wasn't the one who made up the idea. It was another rabbi. I forgot his name, but I believe that it wasn't his idea. But he gets a tremendous credit for it because he promulgated it. He spent tremendous time going all over. He believed in this. Agudas Yisrael convention, 1923. How many participants were there? 600. Okay. This is where he first mentioned the idea that we're going to make this program. There's 7.5 years worth of pages in the Talmud, one a day, and we're all going to do it. All 600 attendees of that convention, it was in Katowice, Poland, they all were makabel to do that fiyomi. All of them. So he saw in his life already.
What?
All of them, right. Svasem is Chavetz Chaim. The whole chevra. There are a lot of things we could say. We could say a whole shiur about all these stories with the cook in that convention, Chavetz Chaim. A lot of things, interesting things. This is August 15th. Now I want to read you. There's a crazy, we had another time, there's a crazy dream that came out of this Chevron Bocher that was died a few weeks ago, but it's not for now. But I want to read you what his sister sent him. Okay, so it's happening in August. The 3rd of Elul. He introduces Daf Yomi, the 3rd of Elul. Okay? Elul is right before which holiday? Rosh Hashanah. Okay? See, after Rosh Hashanah, he sends a letter from his only sister who lived in a far-off village in Bukovina in northern Romania and knew nothing whatever of his activity. So his sister knows nothing about what he's doing, right? It was a small world back then. I saw Usher Resnick with a Palm Pilot. I said, is that what they call, is that what dinosaurs look like? Okay. Listen to this, Rav Moshe. On the night of Rosh Hashanah, I had a dream. I saw you in heaven, dear brother, surrounded by a great mass of angels with striking figures, all radiant as the Rakia. And you, my brother, were standing in the midst, your face alight like the sun in its full strength. You're standing in the middle of all the Malachim, and you look like the sun. And they were all smiling to you as they thanked you. And they rejoice with you. The Malachim are standing around you in the middle, looking like the sun, and they're thanking you, and they're all happy. A lot of Malachim are happy. Please, dear brother, let me know what it means. Is that unbelievable? Okay. So, what else we got to talk about? Hold on a second. Now, Avosai, all the effects of the Daf Yomi, you have to have this. The people were not learning Gemara anymore, right? Balabatim, the Rabbanim learned, but the regular people didn't feel they had any way to learn Daf Yomi, right? There was no, like, Malibu la Gemara. I'm never going to get anything done. I'm never going to finish a Masech. I'm not going to. For years and years and years, they weren't learning Daf Yomi, Gemara. And now he made this plan, and now everybody could get involved. And there's a whole new spirit that came about. And people used to mark their letters, you know, like Jewish people mark their letters, Parshas Mishpatim. They used to mark their letters according to the daf, right? And it engendered a whole daf yomi thinking. There are people who do Yushalmi yomi. There are people who do that, right? A person thinks to himself, right? Even a Rebbe. When can I ever learn Yushalmi? Ah, but Yushalmi yomi. Go to a shir. I could do that, right? Nach yomi. Halacha yomi. Mishnah yomi. I had a friend, Jay Hershkowitz, Shlita, you know? He was the cook in Marsha Kol, very chashuv yid, gevaldig yid, and he learned all the time. He used to learn Nach Yomi, Halach Yomi, Mishnah Yomi, and he finished. I remember a Siyam Ashas that he made. He wasn't a Rav, you know, he's a working man. He made a Siyam Ashas. And you hear about so many people who, you know, my grandfather at 40 started Daf Yomi, 45, 50 started Daf Yomi. He's on his third cycle, fourth cycle. You've heard about that. It was all from him, okay?
Yeah, it's crazy.
He used to say, a daf a day, a groshen a day, like a penny a day. You learn a daf a day and you give give a penny a day to the yeshiva, which we're going to talk about in a second. Okay? And long term, we know what a tremendous hashpah. I don't learn daf yomi myself. I'm not built for it. Yeah? And you know, I think for B'nai Torah, it's not necessarily what they should necessarily be learning if they can't spend it, learn it very well. But do you understand, anybody who's been to the Siyam HaShas, all over the world, what a Kiddush Hashem. Do we have anywhere in the world, MetLife, you know, all these places, hundreds, tens of thousands of Jews getting together, ba'achdus, all, you know, people with kippot zugrot, people with black kippot, Hasidim, Litvaks. He was the one who did all that. It was all from his pure heart. Okay, but now we're going to talk about maybe his most revolutionary thing, which is less known to us, which is, what do we have till 5? We started late. 5:05? Both that we're going to talk about, we're going to go till 5:05, okay? We're going to talk about Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. This was his greatest revolution, right? There were yeshivot, like Panovich, like Mir, like Slobodka, etc. Some of them happened to be positioned in Poland. Mir was in Poland, but they were Lithuanian. The Hasidic world had no yeshivas, right? Up-and-coming Hasidic Bachram used to learn, they would learn all over with some Rebbe or something, and there was no system for them to learn. There was certainly no nice buildings. So he came And he was unshackling all these Hasidic Bachrim from a life of not being able to make it. If a kid wanted to learn, he used to have to get, you know what Teg was? You went somewhere to learn by some rav, right? There was no panimia. Do you guys know what it is? You go downstairs to get the delicious food that Herschel cooks up? Huh? They used to have to go to families every day to get a meal. My great-grandfather-in-law was like that. They used to go, my grandfather left yeshiva because he couldn't put up with this. He used to go every day to someone. You think that's a good feeling? And where would they sleep? They used to be watchmen, right? The owner of the store would lock you in the night before. The whole night you're worried someone's coming in. You'd hear a dog outside. You think you're getting attacked. And then in the morning, he would come and give you a pail of water and say, here, do a sponge on the thing. That's what you got, but you could sleep at least. You got it? And the whole attitude, as the book points out, a rav has to be someone who's powerful, who's not scared. Lo sagur v'meish, not to be scared of everybody. They grew up in a scared atmosphere because they were so dependent on other people. So he comes and says, I'm going to change all that in one fell swoop. I'm going to make a yeshiva, right? I'm going to make a yeshiva. In 1923, he started. He made the Hanachat Eben HaPina, the first cornerstone of the building, was 50,000 people came to the event, all these big Hasidic rabbis, right? The Polish government tried to stop it. How many times? Three times they tried to stop it. The Bund, who was the anti-religious people, said it's the resurrection of the Strimal. And said they didn't want that. They liked the fact that yeshivas and B'nai Torah were down. Who wants these smelly guys? And what he had to do more than anything was he had to fundraise. And he fundraised everywhere. Well, I'll just give you a list of the places he went to. Berlin, who the German Jewry gave him nicely. Vienna, Czechoslovakia, France, Amsterdam, London, Salzburg. And he was in the U.S. after all that, which must have taken 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. He was in the United States for 13 months. Can you imagine that? 13 months, sitting in the U.S., gave how many drushes we said before? Baram, Zachar, Osli, Shlito? 242. 242 drushes in all places in America collecting. And that was a great moment for American Jewry that they got behind him and they gave a lot of money. He got back to Lublin. He was sending money back the whole time. Five out of six stories were built, and it took him years and years to build it. Finally, in 1930, he had the 1930, the yeshiva was established and opened its doors. 100,000 people were there. 100,000 people were there for the opening day cemetery. He went to the cemetery opening day ceremonies. Reuters was there, UP was there. He used the media, by the way, we don't have time to go into it, but he used the media a lot. He was a big believer in media. And the sad thing is the yeshiva only lasted for he was only alive for 3 years. He died in 1933 already, right? Like we said, he was only 46, 47. And the yeshiva, of course, only lasted for about 10 years till the Nazis did their thing. But no, it still is there, and there's still shiurim being given there today. But the point to remember is that what he did then was he did something radical. Okay, so we're going to give me two, three more minutes. We're just going to finish with a hesped that the Sri Deish said about him. The Sri Deish was a gadol from Slobodka. Had nothing to do with Meir Shapiro. Never met him, I don't think. But he was very enthralled by him. Okay, so I'm going to read you, I found this hesped, it's not in this book. It's a eulogy that he wrote. Okay, so listen to this. He gave it in the Chorkov Beis Medrash in Berlin, which is interesting. Okay, he says, I always wanted to know. I'm going to give a free translation. I only knew him in a superficial way, and I dreamt to learn him and understand what was the source of his magic. He had such a magical power, Meir Shapiro. What was the source of his magic? And he says, I went to Lublin and I found it out. In the yeshiva, I found what I wanted to know. If you want to know in Adam Gadol, a great man truly, you have to go see him in his family, what he's really like, right? When the jacket's off, when the tie's down, maybe took off his shirt, only the undershirt is on still, some big tits is flowing out. What's he really about? Meir Shapiro was childless. That's another, he had a lot of tzaras in his life we didn't have time to go into. But I went to see his family. So he says, that's where I found it. Sham be yeshiva re'iti k'dulas, I saw his greatness. Every small thing in the yeshiva interested him. The students were like children. Each and every one was a singular only child to him. And with this love, the love of Torah and the love of Jewish people together, that there was not a dugma ba'olam, there was no one who had the Avos Yisrael and the Avos HaTorah like he had, I finally understood what his magnetism was. Okay, I'm just reading one short other part of the hesped that he offered there. Here is a tremendous, just to end off on a point of leadership, I think everything we've said today is all leadership. If you want to know what a leader is, put a picture of Meir Shapiro and think about the class and you know what a leader was. Ein lehosif, ein legro. Okay? He was very young. And he was filled with a desire to work and accomplish. And in his head, smashed around new programs for the Jewish people. Who? He who created in his head and his optimism, like we spoke about, values that were fruitful and multiplying. And he had the power to displace and set away the clouds of yeish, the clouds of discontent and sadness which were covering the Jewish world, right? L'azriach aleinu shuv, and he put on us a new rays of light. All of him was blossoming, all of him was glory and hope, okay? And now we stand, the Jewish world stands, and we cry for our manig, we cry for our leader. He was the most of the people. You know, Rav Avadia was a Rav Amami Biyoter. You hear such a term? Harav Amami Biyoter. He was the most of the people of all the Rabbanim. The great Talmid Chacham valued him, and he was beloved on everyone. In all the places that he visited, the places were saturated with a joyous spirit. The poorest people would come to him with their little grushin, with their little shekels, with their $5 they collected for Chachmei Lublin, and they would give it to the yeshiva. And they were so happy when his face, like the sun, would shine on them, and to hear his voice, he would put his hand on his shoulder, and then at that point, he chopped that yid for his purposes totally. That yid was given over to him. Leib Yisrael, makashi l'rchoshotcha. How hard is it to acquire the Jewish heart? Leib makal l'rchoshotcha. But how easy it is. If you don't speak the right language to Jews, you have no chance with them. Yeah? Huh? Lots of Jews, lots of problems. But you speak the right language, you got them. Like no other nation in the world. Hamanig amiti. The true leader knows how to get to the Jewish heart. And he carries that perfect treasure, the Jewish heart, and he knows that that's the key to get to the whole person. Right? So he was a manig amiti. That's what real leadership is. That someone who knows where Judaism is and where Klal Yisrael is and knows how to get to them through the power of his love. So there's a tremendous amount to learn. We rushed a little bit, but I think everybody got some picture of who this tremendous person was. So the next time you see people learning Daf Yomi or you go to Lublin, we understand a little bit who was behind all of it. Okay? Well, too.